श्रीला गुरुदेव की जय, श्रीमन महाप्रभु की जय, श्री गिरिराज महाराज की जय, श्री जगन्नाथ बलदेव सुभद्रा की जय, श्री हरि नाम संकीर्तन की जय, गौर भक्त वृंद की जय, गौर प्रमानंद हरि ओ। प्रणाम टू ऑल ऑफ यू, गुड इवनिंग, थैंक्स फॉर कमिंग, वेलकम एंड happy to be here again. Do you need some translation?
Actually, we don't. It's just Baduya will do, I think, online, because...
if there's someone.
Okay.
If Udova joins from...
Okay.
Yeah,
like, you arrange. Yeah. Okay. So, again, welcome and thank you so much for welcoming me one more time. You are pretty, you have lots of hope. Receiving me one more time again. Hopefully there is hope, against hope. And, well, today we are beginning some series of lectures here in Bulgaria for the next, whatever, 9 days or something. So today we will begin with Isagosti, which basically means questions and answers. So whatever question you may have, any topic you may like to share, we will try to say something about it. It's never possible to fully give a complete answer to any question. That gives further hope for further dialogue. But something. Remember, we are dealing here with the infinite. So, I mean, we're trying to deal, and it's not easy to deal with the infinite. But that's the challenge. That's the very situation we are in, being finite. We have the infinite around us, whether we acknowledge that we can feel it or not. So how we as finite beings can relate with the infinite and be successful in that, not be extremely overwhelmed, not be discouraged, not get crazy in the attempt of dealing with the infinite. And of course, not reaching the childish conclusion that we have understood the infinite. That's why I'm saying, I may say something about whatever you have to ask, but try to understand the nature of the topic itself, whether the topic of your question, whether the topic of my response is dealing with the infinite. So there's no end to the question and there is no end to the answer in one point. And that's great. I mean, we shouldn't look for an end to that, because imagine if there's nothing else to say, nothing else to ask about the infinite. At one point, the infinite is no longer infinite, because by very definition, infinite means there's no end to that, no beginning, no end. So in the words of Srila Bhaktirakakshar Dev Goswami Maharaj, what we are trying to do here is just trying to touch one point in an infinite line. And that will be more than enough. I mean, if we are able to get in touch, in contact with the infinite, even one point of the infinite is infinite. It's not that because it's only one point, it's finite. It's still infinite. So that one single point that may be today's topic, whatever it may be, should be enough to satisfy us, the finite. That's the point. No? Our demand as finite beings is... Our thirst will be quenched in connection with the infinite. So, anyhow, some brief words of introduction for you to not have excessive expectations or wrong expectations, in the sense of thinking that okay, we will know everything or we will be able to encompass everything. We are dealing with the infinite. And so be prepared for, we were speaking yesterday, for a good dose of mystery, a good dose of unknowing, a good dose of paradox, all these elements that imply reaching the infinite, start to get closer, if you will. So, and don't be scared of the journey. Hopefully any of those words are like, hopefully not intimidating to us. And if that's so, here we are to give us support one another. That's Krishna's words in the Bhagavad Gita, right at the beginning, right at the end. I mean, the Infinite Himself is speaking. He's saying, he begins the Gita saying, don't fear. He ends the Gita saying, don't fear. And the other day someone told me that in the Bible, the expression don't fear or don't worry or something is 365 times present in the book. So just in case, once per day, you need a reminder that fear is not the way, the currency to deal with life. Not deal with life means deal with the infinite, basically, whether we know it or not. So the opposite. No? Let's try to develop some positive sense of trust and implicit, as I like to say, implicit faith in the unconditional nature and unconditional purpose of reality. So reality all around us has unconditional purpose, whether we want to admit it or not. And we should develop ideally some implicit faith in the unconditional nature of reality and the unconditional purpose and meaning that surrounding us all around. So anyhow, any questions you would like to present, any topic? We have some different meetings of questions and answers, but we have to begin somewhere. I already began my part. So.
I read in your book this idea that our rasa we acquire in many lifetimes from the gurus that we meet in our lifetimes. And there should be like more than one lifetime to have a taste in one rasa so that it becomes prominent in our life. What if we have more than one, how this process goes, like if we meet two gurus that are prominent in our life and they have different rasas, how does it go?
So the implication is that a problem or not, or no? Should be a problem? No, not necessarily. No problem. Again, don't fear. Again, all this is being arranged in one sense. Of course, we have our will, and we play some role in the equation, but there is lots of arrangement from above. No? So also we should have implicit faith in the particular way that bhakti is coming to our lives, in a particular way that love reaches us in the form of sadhu sangha. It's basically, how to say, it's coming with a particular intention in mind, so we should be willing to trust, okay, there won't be conflict, no, everything will be in place. So yeah, the scripture saying that whatever affinity one develops for God ultimately, because there are different possibilities, at least in our school of thought, it's not that you can only relate with God in one single way. To begin with, there is not one single form of God, which is pretty interesting. We do not only say, again, we are speaking about the infinite. So it would be contradictory if I tell you God can only have one form, one name, and only one relationship, because the name of expressing my doctrine or my belief, I'm just imposing limits and limits the divine. He cannot have more than one name. He cannot have more than one, no? And unfortunately, some people think like this. I was watching the other day one interview between one follower of our doctrine and one Christian. And of course, I'm not saying with this that every Christian thinks in the same way, but this one did. And basically, he, of course, quoting this famous line of the Bible, Jesus saying, I'm the truth, the way. Only you can go through the Father through me, and so on. So this has been like hammered upon by many Christians, like basically, okay, surrender. No? But I could say, I understand the point. I mean, there are many things that you can say about that particular line and the context in which that is said, and many Christians understand that way beyond I won't go into that direction, it will be too much, you know, but they make a difference between Jesus and the Christ, and mentioning that that is speaking about the Christ, and the Christ is a universal principle, as we may speak sometimes about also Guru Tattva, Vyashti, Samashti, another point. But my point is that, okay, Bible says that, but also I can quote the Bhagavad Gita and find something similar and hammer on your head with the same idea. As Krishna is saying, Sarvadharmam parityajamamekam sharanambhaya. Abandon all religions, just surrender to me exclusively. So I can make the same case with my book. So what's the conclusion? Then who is right? None of the two. And you go to probably Quran or some other scriptures and they will have some similar verse. So the point is not only one of all us is right and the other ones are just copy-pasting the other traditions and trying to reclaim exclusivity, but basically it's speaking about from a universal principle. So I say this because sometimes we have not even understood that lesson. So if you don't get that lesson, we cannot even try to think about other lessons yet. It will be just distorting, and sometimes that happens. So yeah, to begin with, we have different faces of the Absolute. And even interestingly, if you go to our particular tradition, we won't only say, okay, there are different aspects of the Absolute in other traditions, the different aspects of the Absolute in our tradition. We don't even need to go to other traditions to speak about different aspects of God, but in our own tradition we can speak about so many of them. Of course, we will have some form of, if you will, hierarchy or gradation according to the level of intimacy that you can experience in connection to God. But even if that hierarchy is established, we will be open to accept that not everyone will feel that attracted to the highest level of intimacy with God than others. And everyone will find their particular approach to God, if that's genuine, as the best. And that should be okay. Again, there should be no problem with that. So yeah, according to our tradition, we may say, objectively speaking, the sweetest form of God for us, and we have our way to explain that, will be Krishna in Vrindavan and this and so on. But some other people may say, okay, that's the sweetest approach to God. But as I say, sometimes some people may say, I don't like sweet that much. That's too sweet. I have spiritual diabetes or something. So I cannot take that much sweet. There are many songs that describe this. No, this is famous Madhurashtakam by Balabhacharya, which basically the whole song is using the word Madhuram, Madhuram, Madhuram. Madhuram means in Sanskrit sweet, sweet. And it's saying your flute is sweet, your form is sweet, your cows are sweet, your gopis are sweet, your gopas are sweet. Everything about you is sweet. So if you have diabetes, be careful with that song, because it may be too much sweetness. So again, someone may say, no, I don't like sweet that much. I like apples instead of mangoes. I say, but apples are not that sweet. Yeah, I know. But I like apples more. Is that a problem? You are at fault because you don't like the sweetest fruit of earth? That's not your favorite? No. So the same way, we have to have this type of, if you will, religious tolerance. And not only tolerance, like, oh, I have to tolerate these guys who don't like sweet that much. But religious broad-mindedness and acceptance and even appreciation and... And not only that, but even inspiring from those who have a different inspiration than ours. And that's important. That's not so easy. It's easier said than done. It's not so easy to be inspired by those who are, with whom we disagree in some aspects. We tend to agree, to be inspired, quote-unquote, if that we can call that inspiration, only with those we agree with. No, and that's really dangerous, because that ends up being fanaticism, fundamentalism. Only if you agree with me, you inspire me, I love you, I allow you my group, and so on. And you make your own group of people and followers and friends. All of you like with each other. But actually, in depth, nobody know each other, basically. But they love each other. They like each other. oh, how nice what you put. And all of them remain in the comfort zone without challenging each other's situation, because they are not actually deeply getting into knowing each other. So that's not the idea. That's my point. Sometimes we have to describe what's not our idea to make clear what's our idea. So in that connection, Srila Rupa Goswami, as Radha Giridhar is quoting, he mentions, in order to develop, it's more technical and complex than that, the experience of Bhakti Rasa. It's a compound of different experiences. This is very technical Sanskrit definition, so I won't torture today with that. But Bhakti Rasa is actually the combination of 5 types of ingredients or experiences which put together make for one experience called Bhakti Rasa. Now you have to have Stai Bhav, Anu Bhav, Bi Bhav, Sattvika Bhav, and Vyabhichari Bhav. Different emotional components which mix together in the proper form and quantity make for one unique experience called Bhakti Rasa. Sometimes the example given is of some food preparation that entails 5 ingredients. And each one of 5 ingredients can be a separate food preparation in themselves. But if you mix them in a unique way, oh, you taste that and you know that's a particular preparation known, whatever the name. So Bhakti Rasa means different spiritual, emotional ingredients mixed in a certain way that give a very particular, sweet, capturing experience called Bhakti Rasa. My Guru Maharaj would like to call it sacred aesthetic rapture. Very interesting definition. So we are completely captured by that particular experience, which is sacred. And the idea of aesthetic has to do with also the power of how beauty, in this case we could say, has the greatest power to draw our attention and to make us not know anything else apart from that, basically. We have that experience on some degree in this world, when we are in front of a very astonishing, beautifully, whatever, piece of art or landscape or whatever, you become totally captured. I'm full of chamatkar, another Sanskrit word. Chamatkar means astonishment. Astonishment, wonder, sense of wonder. That in the ancient Indian tradition, it is always mentioned like a very key ingredient for the highest goal of life. Many people in different traditions, similarly, like have this intimation, like, ideally, real life should be filled with wonder. We shouldn't lose our sense of wonder, of sense of rediscovering new layers of reality and remaining in that state of astonishment. Not in a naive, forced way, but in a real way. I mean, if you are properly practicing whatever tradition you belong to, your mysticism, if you will, that has to keep you in a permanent state of wonder. Of discovery, of learning. Real learning is wonder. Real learning is just new information. Take it. Okay, now I know something else. I've learned something. Real learning is more transformation than information. There may be some information, but given in such a way, received in such a way, that the actual experience is transformation. So when you experience yourself being transformed, that's what sometimes we call sacred wonder. And nothing else matters at that point. There is no place for any other thing, basically. You enter in touch with the real foundations of reality as it is. So this Bhakti Rasa, my point is full of this wonder. The Shastra is saying, Rasa Sar Chamatkar, or the essence of the experience of Bhakti Rasa is this feeling of sacred wonder. So take... protect your wonder. Take care of your sacred wonder. Nowadays, world which sometimes externally, superficially seems to provide us with constant sense of wonder, but it's in a very predictable way. Well, let's see what's new message. Is there someone, what the new publication? But that's not chamatkar. That's not wonder. Because that's operating on a very predictable, unlimited framework when you're just moving in on a very superficial level of reality. So, and we take reality for granted, and we become more and more mechanical in our, how to say, in our traversing the path. So, and we lose the sense of wonder. It's interesting if you pay attention to nowadays to the world, all these facilities. Of course, I'm not against technology. I mean, you can just see in front of me. But it's a fine line. Mm-hmm. Potentially, technology is wonderful, but potentially it can be hell. It's not intrinsically, it's not favorable nor unfavorable. So in our tradition, we always make this... And I'm going to your answer. It's just a little bit of context. In our tradition, we may emphasize this. Now, there are certain favorable things to do, unfavorable things to reject. Now, there are certain things that are not unfavorable, nor favorable, like social media. That's not necessarily favorable. That's not necessarily unfavorable. It depends how you deal with that, that it will be favorable or unfavorable. So it's not so much about what to do, what not to do, but how to do something that potentially can be whether one thing or the other. So, and nowadays people have so many more facilities than in other ages, if you will, or times. People is generally much more bored than before. Full of predictability, not having too much creativity, just trapped into particular, very limited options. So, sense of wonder is retiring. And the more you retire sense of wonder in one sense, the more life stops having meaning, basically. I mean, you enter into nihilism, you say in English, nihilism. There's no purpose. No purpose is another way of saying no sense of wonder. Because you do so many things, but there's no real motivation, if you will. So again, Bhakti Rasa is for us the ultimate goal of life, which implies you are thrown forever in a constant pool of wonder. Indeed, one of our authors wrote a book called Bhakti Rasa Amrita Sindhu, which means an ocean of that. So like implying the goal is that you will be living, swimming internally in an ocean of that. And then he wrote another book, which is called Ujjvala Nilamani, which means blazing sapphire. Sapphire, you say? Like implying, okay, you will be thrown in that ocean, but that ocean also has so many levels. So if you go deep into the ocean, you will find some gems and precious stones. So there is one blazing sapphire waiting for you there in the ocean of Bhakti Rasa. So he uses all this poetic analogy to try to describe, make justice, say something about his own experience of sacred wonder. I mean, they are living in that ocean, and they are trying to imagine someone eternally living in that ocean and trying to put in words to those who have never touched, been sprinkled by a drop of that ocean, what's that ocean about? That's not so easy. But they have tried. Very nice, really nice. The result of that is many of the sacred books we have. So Bhakti Rasa, this experience of Bhakti Rasa is coming to us, in contact with those who have it, in contact with those who have experienced that. And Rupa Goswami mentioned this is such a comprehensive experience that you won't reach this very easily, I mean very soon, which is an important point. He even makes the point, it may require more than one lifetime. And Srila Rupa Goswami, when saying this, he's also basing many things that he mentioned. Also, there is a system of rasa in India that is actually what Rupa Goswami did is very interesting, because he took the rasa theory, which existed in India before him, and applied that to transcendence, to spiritual practice. But before he did that, this same theory of rasa and different experience, aesthetic experiences and so on, was limited to the secular world and to the experience of the arts. There is a book called Natya Shastra, what one said called Bharat Muni, and he developed a whole system of how to properly appreciate art, so to reach the experience of rasa, But his idea of rasa there is not transcendental. It's just experience of wonder while appreciating a piece of music, mostly, or dance. In India, in the old times, all this was put together. Drama, dancing, acting, singing. And for you to fully appreciate that, the artists should depict their work, of course, being accomplished in what they are doing, but also the audience should be what he calls Saharidai, which means like expert in, there are so many words that you cannot translate in English, like a connoisseur. No, you have to be expert in understanding what's taking place. You follow. If you are expressing a very subtle piece of art, but you don't have the ear trained for that, you may just fall asleep or not appreciate. You may say, it was good. But you are not grasping the subtleties and the details that a connoisseur will be maybe crying and feeling so many things by this and that and that. But someone else is it was nice. And the other person was like, nice? Only nice? And just jumping on you. Like, how can you say only nice? But each one were able to appreciate on a certain level. So this same idea applies to... and he's saying, Bharat Muni, my opponent, he's saying, for you to taste rasa in a secular sense, to have this like experience of wonder while appreciating arts in this world, to fully reach that experience, probably you would need more than one lifetime of preparation for you as the audience, for you to really appreciate that. Because again, Indian arts are very refined, very subtle, and it's not just let's go to a punk rock concert or something like that. No, with all respect, if there are some punk rock followers here. So my point is, he's saying, even to taste that experience on the secular level, you may need one lifetime of preparation. Because you need to be educated about different things, different branches of knowledge and how to understand what's being said and the mudras and the language and the... Oh my God, so many things. So if that's applied to secular rasa, now Rupa Goswami is taking that and applying that to spiritual experience, probably minimum the same will be required. So he's actually very generous to say at least one lifetime. Like implying it can be more. And there comes all this whole idea that, of course, more than one lifetime implies the notion of reincarnation, that of course is universally entertained in Hinduism, and of course not everyone will accept for the particular reasons outside of Hinduism, or some people inside India for sure. That's a different, separate conversation, but it's an interesting one, especially considering, how misapplied can this idea be. If I tell you, you have many lifetimes, eternal, all the lifetimes you need to reach the goal, that can be problematic also, in the sense of you can abuse that idea. I have eternity, so I can relax, no rush. Someday, some life, I will do it. And sometimes people feel, I have only one lifetime. So they try to, of course, maybe the motivation to become serious is just the clock is running. No. And maybe, I have to surrender to God in this lifetime, I have to be a good person, because if not, what will happen? So the main motivation is, I want to avoid the bad stuff that will come if I'm a disaster in this lifetime. So, again, Krishna in the Gita says, Arto Jignyasur Artarti Brahm Jnani Chas Bharatarsha. Some people approach me because of fear. And he said, we have to begin somewhere. It's okay. He's not condemning them. But he's also making the case, that's not the highest motivation. If you approach God, like, please, help me so I don't have to suffer in hell. Actually, the main interest is not so much in God himself. It's like, please give me what I need so I don't have to suffer as I will if you don't give me what I need. So it's basically self-centered. And Krishna will say, well, at least he came to me. No. He will see the half As we say in, I don't know if you have the same saying here, half the glass, the full, half, what we say?
Half empty or half
full. Yeah, half full glass. He will see that, okay, he came to me at least. He could have asked help here and there. He's asking me, let's begin somewhere. But hopefully in time we mature and realize, oh, I can approach the divine with some other motivation. I may be interested in who the divine is. So again, my point is many lifetimes, one lifetime, depending how we approach that, that can be abused even. Of course, that's not the idea. So Rupa Goswami is mentioning there's you need more than one lifetime, not to discourage anyone, but just to make it clear the price to pay. I mean, in this lifetime, you may have to work 50 years to buy a car, a house or something. So here you want to buy, quote-unquote, a permanent position in eternity. And you think that just a few years more and I have my house there, if you will, or something. And of course, it's not about number of years. No? It's about quality of how much you invest yourself in relation to the ideal. When the Bhagavatam began, Parikshit Maharaj is another different conversation, but Parikshit Maharaj, as you know, many of you, he received an unexpected, invitation to die in 1 week. He was totally thrown out of the comfort zone. Try to get the symbology of this that you find in different traditions again. How does the main book, at least for us, begin? Bhagavad? He is the emperor of the world. He has all enjoyment, all good position, all repute. Everything is in place materially. Whenever you less expect, you receive the news, you have 1 week, and in 1 week you are dying. So you are immediately thrown out of the comfort zone, in a situation that is totally unknown. Of course, it sounds like very extreme, generally. So the Bhagavatam is presenting a particular stage, like on the basis of which everything else will unfold. Like implying, if you don't get this, you won't get what comes after this. And what do you have to get? Well, Parikshit Maharaj, again, was thrown out of the comfort zone, but he accepted that. That's my point. He embraced the unknown, as if you want to put it in Jungian terms. He was thrown to the unknown, and he embraced that. And he entered the forest, and he started to look for his guru. He didn't look back, if you will. He followed the call. And of course, his guru appeared in a very unexpected way. I mean, Parikshit Maharaj is the example of the essence seeker, Sauragrahi. The very name he has indicates that. Parikshit means the examiner. Examiner? So to say that he saw Krishna in the womb. So that's, to begin with, pretty interesting. Generally, it's not the case that you have darshan, vision of God in the womb, and you go out of the womb and immediately start to look for that person you saw in the womb. He did that. He saw Krishna in the womb. Went out of the womb, start to look for Krishna. And he start to examine every person. Are you the person I saw in the womb? No. Are you there? No. Are you? So that's why he was called the examiner. Parikshit. Parikshit. Iksha means to look, and pari means every direction. So he was in every direction inquiring. Where is the truth, basically, inquiring, from day one. So that's a very important point. So, again, he was thrown out of the comfort zone. You have 7 days to live. And we have to inhabit these stories, no? Like empathize and think, what will I do if that happens to me? Try to imagine you receive it. Of course, that won't happen. Generally, that you don't receive like a WhatsApp message, 7 days to live. That would be interesting. I mean, that would be a blessing because you have at least 1 week to prepare. And generally, as the Mahabharata said, Yudhishthira Maharaj said, generally people live as they will never leave this body, which is pretty astonishing. And they see around them, everyone is leaving their body. And the more you get closer to leave your body, the more people leave their body. I mean, everyone, the more people leave their body in the sense of probably the more people you know Of course, everyone is leaving their body at every moment. Even if not officially, it's one day less, if you will. Again, not in a tragic sense, because leaving their body is changing your t-shirt, to be strictly speaking. So I don't think that changing your t-shirt is a tragic experience during their day. No, you don't seem that traumatized for having your new t-shirt for today. And if tomorrow you come with a new one, how was the trauma? It's okay. Are you okay? I could just say, oh, it's okay. It's like, But we are so much engrossed and identified with the t-shirt that when it's time to take it out and put the new one, it's like, no. So it's interesting how that works. But so Parikshit Maharaj was totally thrown out of that comfort zone, and he accepted that. He embraced the situation. He didn't escape from that. He didn't kill himself. He didn't took it lightly. He realized that's going to happen. He realized that. He embraced it fully. And he looked for his guru. And again, his guru was not coming in the most typical packaging. No, because generally you say, okay, I will look for my guru. And like it or not, most of us have this idealization, generally a romantic one, how a guru should be. And you idealize, I mean, each one with your own samskaras. But many will idealize, I don't know, the old Indian fellow, long dreadlocks and long beard, or whatever. Each one according to what idea you have, no? Floating or whatever, and older than me. And in the case of Parikshit Maharaj, it was exactly the opposite to all that. Parikshit Maharaj was the emperor of the world, a man with experience, relatively elder, and his guru was a 16-year-old naked teenager. That's his guru. Try to imagine. And he could be his son in age, Sukadev Goswami. He was looking for his guru, and this boy came without clothes, without realizing there were no clothes. He was beyond t-shirt, as we were speaking today, beyond t-shirt, so he was not aware of that. But Parikshit Maharaj realized, that's my guru. Even though he didn't appear as what you may think a guru will be. Boy, no clothes, like totally oblivious to what's taking place. So he was a real seeker, that's my point. So he had these seven, my point is they have 7 days to live. And he asked Sukadeva Goswami, his guru, Gurudev, I have 1 week to live. Is that enough to reach my goal, the ultimate goal? And Sukadeva Goswami kind of chuckled and said, 1 week? More like feeling, that much time you need? He basically said, one moment, he said. What would take on 1 week? One moment is more than enough. If you pay proper attention in the proper direction and you hear from the proper source and you act properly, 1 instant is enough. There are some examples in Shastra about that. Of course, it sounds very idealistic. We generally do not see people in 1 second. But if you, potentially speaking, if you think properly, that can happen in 1 moment. Of course, if you don't do things properly, that can take, you cannot count. So the point of Rupa Goswami is to attain this highest perfection. Ideally, it could be in 1 moment, but generally it takes time because we need to acquire certain impressions. We have to, if you will, in Christian terms, transubstantiate. They will speak about the transubstantiation of from matter to spirit. So we have to modify our sense of self in a way that is not traumatic, but in a way that is natural, organic. Like we were speaking today, quoting Richard Rohr and his 2 ideas in Falling Upward, when he says, he speaks in, actually it's a Jungian idea of the 2 halves of life. So the first one is container, the second one is content. So first one, container, means you have to first of all have a basic notion of who you are in the world. Your name, your form, your race, your color, your gender, your society, your family, and you have sense, some sense of identity. If you don't have that, you go crazy. But then, that's the container, he says. Eventually, that container has to be filled. As we mentioned, and the analogy is good because he's not saying you have to destroy the container. No. You have to keep the container to fill it. But you have to keep it to fill it, not for something else. No, it has some purpose because it will allow the filling process then. So we have our sense of identity, mind-body complex, or what sometimes we call our ego, what we consider we are as a person here. We are not saying, destroy that, that's illusory or anything, but we are saying, okay, have that properly in place in a balanced way, have your humanity properly balanced, and then feel that. That's the content. Balanced humanity is the content. The container. Now feel that. No need to destroy the container, because if you destroy the container, you can put anything inside, anything. So, but there has to be some process in which we develop another sense of identity. I mean, we have done that in this lifetime. I don't think that all of you, when you were 5 years, 15 years, now 20, 30, 40, I won't point at anyone, just in case, 40. And beyond. I think you know that you are the same person in one substantial sense. It's not that they are different people and they are changing, putting one and the other one. But at the same time, you realize the idea of how I see myself, my sense of self, has changed dramatically. And that's not bad. That's my point. That's not a problem. Of course, we should know in which direction that change has to continue. For eternity. So that may, my point is, that may take time. So Rupa Goswami is saying that may take more than one lifetime. No problem, no rush. It's a big project for eternity. So we have to be, again, ready to pay that price. We have to know, as we were speaking the other day, we not only need to know what's the price to pay, but also what's the currency in which I have to pay my price. Because first, that happens to me sometimes when I'm traveling. Now the plane is reminding me of that. That you are, I don't know, traveling, and I mean, I don't used to buy almost anything anywhere, but sometimes I need to buy, I don't know, a bottle of water in the airport or something. And how much is a bottle of water? Oh, €3. So, but I don't have euro. Oh, sorry, change money somewhere. So, I don't know. So my point is, not only is it enough to know how much, but which is the currency. If I don't have the currency, even if I have $1 million, they may say, only euro, sorry. So similarly, regarding this spiritual project, the price to pay, but the currency in which that will be, in which will we invest ourselves. So going to the question, this was an introduction to the question. And probably the reply to the question will be shorter than the introduction, so don't get nervous. 45 minutes to the introduction, when will be the question ending? And we're supposed to be a space for more questions. So the question is, so what happens if this takes more than one lifetime? And in different lifetimes, one has different gurus. And from different gurus, one receives different Bhakti Rasa impressions, if you will, different affinities for Krishna in one direction, in another. Because that can happen. I mean, if your guru in this lifetime is a devotee who is advanced enough as to go after this, leaving this body to Krishna, if you will, but you need to come again, if you will. It's not that my guru has to come again back only for me. In that sense, he or she will never be able to, because there will always be some disciple like Gurudev come. So someone else may come in representation of that particular mood and so on. So I will say that, you know, like, for example, but even if, I mean, if you have a particular guru, let's say this is your first lifetime practicing bhakti and you receive your first association with a particular bhakta in a particular devotional mood, that creates some samskara or impressions in you, and you have some affinity in that direction, and at the end of this lifetime, that guru will continue his journey somewhere else, go into Krishna Lok or whatever. But if you have some particular samskara inclination for that, Krishna, if you will make the arrangement for receiving further guidance in that direction, or at least in the direction that is not contradictory to that. That can happen also. For example, famous example that my Guru Maharaj quotes sometimes is the one of Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada, he will speak about himself, about being practicing bhakti for some other lifetimes. Of course, some devotees will think Srila Prabhupada is Nitya Siddha, eternally liberated. Some other will think Sadhana Siddha. As Srila Prabhupada himself said, no problem, the important word here is Siddha. So then let's not make a whole conflict because of that. We have already enough conflicts to solve than to make a new one. But the point is, if you choose to see him as someone who attained perfection through practice and not an eternally perfected personality, he will describe himself as someone who practiced in a previous lifetime. And interestingly, if you consider that perspective, okay, this great personality has been practicing from a previous lifetime, and now in this lifetime, he's showing some clear affinity towards Krishna in Sakya Bhav as a friend. But his guru has not that affinity in that lifetime, interestingly. Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta, he clearly expressed an affinity towards Madhurya Bhav, the romantic type of service towards Krishna. Again, is that a problem? No. Because you put the two of them together and the mix, the result of the mixing is Priyanarma Sakya, which is you have a friendly relationship with Krishna, but you are those type of friends who are aware of his romantic life and serve him in that connection. So I'm giving this just as one example as to how Krishna is making those arrangements, when even if there is some different influence in one life and the other, it's not a, oh, now what to do? It's contradictory and this is disturbing. It's nothing happening. And we cannot just like calculate everything, like how in my next lifetime I will get this particular guru. And we have to trust that Krishna will make way better arrangement than whatever we can even think. So we should try to develop implicit faith that that will be the case. And of course, before even thinking about that, we should be asking ourselves what I'm doing at present to someday reach there. Because to begin with, we have to be proper. If before thinking in terms of, okay, well, I will serve Krishna in this mood and that mood, the question is how I'm serving Guru, Vaishnavas and Mahaprabhu in Dasya. How much do I... Are you digesting the pill of servanthood, if you will? How much do I understand that? How much willing I am to be a servant? And again, how much do I understand that? Because the word servant for some is horrible, basically. Because in this world, that's not a very like chased after term. No? You go to the street, would you like to be a servant? They're like, no, thank you. I like to be a boss. I want to have servants. Because we connect the word servant with how servanthood is expressed in this world, and that's not generally very interesting. So we may need to recalibrate our understanding of, as we were speaking the other day, of many of the terms we use on a daily basis. Even in our own Gaudiya lexicon, we were say servant and this and blah, this word, surrender and love. And we may take for granted all these words. We know when to say them, in which how to reply, but we may not be playing out the implications of these words. So we need to remain open to that. What does it mean to be a servant for me today? And you have to be able to discover a new layer of response to that. A new layer of sacred wonder. Because if not, probably I'm just sticking with, like, very static, not ecstatic, but static interpretations of these terms, and just guiding my spiritual life with very old ideas, if you will. Like, I heard once that this is, means to be a servant. And maybe that's true, but maybe you need to update your understanding of that word 25 years after that. And still that's true on some level, but on the level you are now, you need a new level of presenting and expressing that same truth to you. So, yeah, in brief, yeah, there's no worry. Krishna will make the arrangements. Anyhow, sorry for overextending with the question, but some other topics came. But we have time for some few questions, or yeah, we're not English.
Hare Krishna, could you please talk on the topic, if it's okay, Sharanagati, in the sense of how to get from the point of understanding mentally how important the surrender to God is, to getting to the point, probably years or lifetimes later, of actually surrendering.
I repeat, just because in case it's not here, some words on Saranagati, which means surrender, or taking shelter in Krishna. How to do that, even especially for some years we have heard about that, spoke about that, and even you may hear, may think I'm surrendered, and how to go from that point to actually being surrendered. Which is a tricky question. I mean, it's not that you are tricky, but the point is, like, the topic in itself is tricky, in the sense of, if someone is surrendered to God, generally you won't hear that person will say, I'm surrendered to God. If someone is loving, generally you won't hear those people saying that they love. On the contrary, in this world, people say, I love you, so you can say, I love you very easily. But walking the talk, that's a very, very different story. And you can say, I love you, and then wait some few years and look back, and then reflect on how much content was in those words, how much seriously you pronounce, how much aware you were of the implications of what it means to love someone. And probably we will realize, I didn't have a clue about what love is. No. And even you can be using those expressions to actually express exactly the opposite thing. When actually you are saying, I'm so delighted from all the enjoyment I can draw from you for myself. I mean, you won't say that. This is not so romantic to tell that to your partner. So better you say, I love you. That sounds pretty much nice. Of course, you may not even aware of that. It's not that you are calculating. I'm totally exploiting you, but I cannot say that. So, I love you. Bring some roses. No, probably you are not aware that's going on. And the two sides are in the same way. They actually think I love each other. And then after a few weeks or something, they start to realize, what's going on? Magic is over. Where is that experience I had the first day? Of course, the lesson is welcome to the world of love. You say, I love you so many times the first week, so now you have to pay the price of over-expressing that, which has so much depth and such a price. Love is not as cheap as we may think. It's not just mere infatuation. I mean, real love has to do with sacrifice and commitment and responsibility and so many things that generally we are not willing to pay that much. Again, the price, the currency. So Saranagati is similar, because Saranagati for us is the preliminary stage for love. Mm. Our goal is love, and we want to love God, but that is such a high thing that many of our teachers have not spent that much time speaking about that. Not because that's not the highest thing, but because before reaching there, you have to reach so many other rooms in the house before reaching to the top. And if you don't have that clear enough, you may want just to reach to the to the rooftop, but you have to enter some other rooms. You cannot just jump from outside the house to the rooftop. You have to enter the house and go first floor, second floor, third floor, rooftop. No. If you try to jump on climb the house outside and enter the rooftop through some window, you may fall and kill yourself, basically. No? So Saranagati is one of these like unavoidable rooms that we have to pass. And not as something like, oh, I have to pass, okay, just in order to get my what I want. No, you have to love that. No? So much that experience in that room actually will accompany you to the next room, and the other one to the next room. It's not that you pass one part, I will never see you again, but goodbye, Saranagati. No, goodbye, surrender. Oh, I did my homework. Now I can do what I really want. It doesn't work like that. That's the uniqueness of bhakti, because in many other paths, you have this particular like phenomenon. Like it's, you have something in mind, and you do so many things you don't like, so finally you can attain what you want. That happens a lot even in this world. People is working many times doing something they hate to get money so they can on the weekends do what they think they like. But even substantially speaking, they do not like even that. They think they like that. But the point is, sometimes we are willing to do something we don't like, but we are just thinking, oh, whenever this is over, I will be able to finally do what I like. So some people even approach God in those terms. Okay, what I have to do, okay, this fasting, this penance, so as a reward, I receive what I want. That happens with all the paths described in the Vedas: karma, jnana, yoga. In karma, you do all these rituals and worship, so you go to Swarga and you enjoy heavenly delights. But before enjoying those heavenly delights, you have to do so much penance here. So if it feels, oh, you like penance, and he will say, no, I don't like penance. I am doing this so I can fully enjoy them. So like, okay. Or a jnani is doing so much things so finally they can enter Brahman and leave all the other things they were doing behind. Or a yogi may restrain himself and do all these types of discipline so they can obtain whatever type of mystic perfection of powers. But the bhakta or devotee, he or she is doing something, and you will ask them why you're doing this. And what's the ideal reply that the devotee will give? Tell me. Let's see how much.
To please Krishna.
Okay, so another word of saying that is, I'm doing this. So if that pleases Krishna, will you like to continue doing that?
Yes.
So in one way you are saying, I'm doing this so I can continue doing this. You follow? Because you are serving Krishna, and why you are serving Krishna, you will reply, so I can continue serving Krishna. And it's like, wait a minute. No, but you are doing this for obtaining something else. And the Lord said, no, there's not something else apart from that. This is the something else. You follow? So it's another logic. So my point with this is, it's not that I surrender to Krishna, so I finally after that can, whatever, take rest, go on vacation, have my eternal cloud in heaven, and you surrender because at one point you develop a taste for that. So you continue doing that. You find no limit in that. It's not that, okay, I surrendered fully, I cannot surrender more. That's absurd. Because again, we are speaking about connection with the infinite. So again, I cannot say I love. If I love you, I won't say I love you, because there's so much more that I can love someone. That if I say I love you, it implies like I'm already doing that. if you speak with one great artist, I mean, with this I'm not forbidding, do not say I love you anymore, because now you know what's the truth. I'm not saying that, but at least have in mind this point. Like if you are a great, I don't know, artist or something, the greater there are, they will never say, I'm reached perfection in my art. They will feel like, I'm just starting to realize how little I know. And you on the other side say, but nobody knows like you. whatever. That's my experience, they will tell you. Because they are getting closer to a level of perfection when there is no limit for perfection. Many artists will say that. Perfection is doesn't exist, technically speaking. You never reach perfection. You can always reach further perfection. Further perfection. So, that's interesting. So, surrender has to be something we... I'm saying this because you mentioned this idea, when we are finally surrender. Well, you may never feel that. And that will keep you on track forever. And if you see the devotees of Krishna in Golok Vrindavan, it's not that you go to the Brajavasis and you interview them and they will say, we are so surrendered. There's nobody like us. We are the greatest devotees. I mean, on the contrary, they have so many stories where they feel we are ordinary beings, ordinary people. But somehow, what good fortune we may have done in our previous life, Krishna is one among us. But they will never say, we have this and that. And they do not feel that. They are not making a show. They really feel, I'm ordinary. But at the same time, they feel, I'm the most blessed person on earth. Mm. So we have to learn to coexist with this type of paradoxical experiences. It's not that they are proud. It's that not they are not fooling themselves. They really feel, I'm nothing too extraordinary nor special, but Krishna is in the midst of us and that makes my life so special. And they feel so fortunate, so humbled, so fortunate. So it's a whole art to accommodate these emotions in a way that is healthy, sustainable, not dysfunctional. So surrender is paradoxical, like humility. Humility is paradoxical. It's like, how do you say in English?
In Espanol?
I don't know. Anti-reflective quality? I don't know if there's one expression. Like the idea is, the moment you affirm you have it, you don't have it. Mm-hmm. If I tell you, I have humility, immediately I show I don't have humility. I cannot affirm that I have it. Because if I do it, I lose it. Other things you can affirm it, and they are true. I mean, I don't know, you go to the gym and your biceps are expanding, and you have physical strength more than before. And you can say that, and it's not that your arms will go like... They won't shrink. They're there. You can affirm that. It's okay. You know? But if you say, I have humility, it retires. It's a very unique... And Saranagati goes hand by hand with humility. You cannot, if you take humility out of the equation, you cannot speak about surrender. And of course, again, this is another word that we need to relearn, because for us, surrender in this world means, what do you relate surrender with? Especially in countries connected with war experience and things like that. Surrender means surrender. Oh. White flag. Come on. So you surrender, but because you don't have other options. It's not that you choose to surrender. I mean, you have no other option. It's not that, oh, I have many options and I choose surrender. Yeah, I have two options, surrender or... So being killed. So we generally do not relate the idea of surrender with a voluntary act.
Surrender.
Okay, here we have. Surrender should be voluntary. I mean... But generally, subconsciously, sometimes we may connect surrender with forced situation. Like, I have to surrender. I don't have other option. Okay, I have to surrender. Not so much like, I want to surrender. I choose to. I reach the conclusion that I need to surrender. I want to surrender. I choose to surrender. This type of associations in our mind. So pay attention to from which side you are surrendering. Because we don't want surrender. Any form of surrender, certain form of surrender. You follow my point? It's not that, Maharaj, I surrender to Krishna. Why? Which is the background? Are you fearful because you have no other option? And Krishna is not like a general pointing with the gun and saying, surrender. He says surrender to me in the Gita. But in a certain way. That's the conclusion of the Gita. Before saying surrender to me, Krishna is speaking... 690 verses. So we won't misunderstand his invitation to surrender. He's not pointing at Arjuna, surrender to me. He's given so many options and so much knowledge and expressing how he's our great well-wisher, our best friend, and this and that. Surrender to me. Okay, it's natural. But he's backing that with so many things. And then he says some other things as well. Still, he says at the end, do not fear. Although he spoke the whole Gita, and we should not be fearful of surrender to Krishna, just in case he's saying, do not fear. I told do not fear at the beginning. Do not fear. I'm not that bad of a guy, Krishna's saying. So surrender has to be, and of course it's not surrender, it's not just, okay, I'm surrender now. I press the surrender button. Okay, I'm on the other side. I'm on the surrender party. It's a gradual process. Generally, again, may take lifetimes. Going back to that topic, you know, it's a gradual process. Because sometimes we may make that mistake. Like, I'm not surrender. I'm not surrender. And you can torture yourself. And maybe you are not surrender on some level, but you are surrender on another level. Because if you think in terms, I'm not surrender, and when I will be surrender, you are thinking in these terms like, someday I'm surrender. I was not surrender, and now I'm surrender. Like black and white. Not surrender, surrender. Not surrender, surrender. It's not like this. Today you are surrender on this level and not surrender on this level. Tomorrow, hopefully, the proportion changed a little bit. Still you are surrender on one level and still you are not surrender on one level. But gradually you are moving. So I think that's, I mean, many things surrender can take a few lifetimes of doing series of lectures only about that. But the gist of surrender, in Krishna says, and the Acharya says, the spirit of surrender is Rakshishyati Tibishwaso Goptri Tui Vananam. Which means, I trust that Krishna will protect me, and I accept Krishna as my maintainer. Which again, doesn't have to do with forcing something, but just acknowledging something that is already taking place. No. Surrender is not something about accept this stuff that before that did not exist. No, just realize that this that is already taking place. No. That you are being maintained, you are being protected, you are being nourished by God. Of course, there is a whole process to realize that and become aware of that. But that is the central spirit of surrender. Which means, I take shelter in Krishna. I understand why I need to take shelter to begin with. There are so many implications. No? Because I take shelter, I say, why do I need to take shelter? So you need to understand why you need to take shelter. And why, without the shelter, you are taking false shelter. Because we are all taking shelter somewhere. But the point is that ashraya or is durashraya? Is shelter or is so-called shelter? Where you are investing your hopes, where you are investing your sense of identity, your sense of security in something that is actually real or is something that is illusory? Because it can be illusory and you can just invest in yourself in whatever, you name it, you give whatever example you like. No? So first you need to understand a need to take shelter. Before speaking about shelter, again, here we are not selling shelters, no? Like, buy the shelter, accept the shelter, but first understand why you need that. Because if you don't get that, surrender won't be voluntary again. Voluntary means, I understand. I mean, I choose to do that, and I choose to do that because I understood that I need to do that, not because someone sold me the product very nicely. So, yeah, I choose. Like when you go to this, I don't know, to the mall or something. Yeah, I choose to buy this, but actually you are being brainwashed by media or something, and you think you are choosing, but they are just telling you what to buy, how to think, what. But you say, no, I choose it. I'm totally free and independent of doing what I like. Yeah, okay. That's part of the trick, you know, that they make you think that you're totally free and independent. So you have to really understand, I need shelter. I'm in danger, in one sense, if I don't take shelter. I'm living a life where I'm thinking one thing that is not. If that's happening, again, if that's not happening, that's idea, but we may be living a life in which we are not aware of who we are to begin with. I'm misreading reality, and so much suffering and confusion can be there. So that means we need shelter. Shelter means we need knowledge, we need enlightenment, we need affection, we need especially unconditional affection. I mean, we are so needy, technically, really. And that's not the wrong word. But the problem is that generally we are not willing to recognize that. No, somehow we have bogged the product of, again, perfection. So we have to show ourselves perfect and full. I don't need anything. But we are being totally full of doubts and fragile and vulnerable. But we don't want to acknowledge that. Because there is this subtle but extreme fear. If someone realizes how needy I am, people won't love me as I am. So, because it seems that everyone is only buying the product which seems perfect. So I have to look perfect. So I'm a candidate for something or someone. Very subtly, this type of narrative is there in the minds of most. I have to show myself perfect, although I know I'm a disaster, but at least I have to sell the product with this good marketing. No. But in the background, you are totally needy, and if you are not addressing that, acknowledging that, I mean, in time, that's unsustainable and totally dysfunctional. And the only way we can transcend that is by entering in touch with unconditional love. Basically, that we will feel, wow, I don't need to show perfection here. I need to show imperfection here to be loved. If you are in front of a saintly person, enlightened person, that person will tell you, please do not make any show here. Please do not present any facade. No, how do you say? Facade. No, no masks here. No need of that. Leave them outside of the stage. Get down the stage for a minute. Show you in raw form, as you are, naked, if you will. And we're like, no? Because again, we are not accustomed to that. And whenever we try to do so many times, we have been abused, exploited. So we are like, we learn all these defense mechanisms that you have, like mistrusting reality at every step. Fear, the opposite of love. So the cure for that is to, again, have an direct experience of unconditional love. You know, that you have to really feel that. I'm being loved by someone in a substantial way. Now here is, I'm not limiting that to romantic interaction, but real love has not to do with one or this type of mood, but just for who I am, for who I can be now. You know, something like that. And for all that I can be. You know. That's real unconditioned love. The person is loving you with all the disaster stuff that's still there. But because that person can see right beyond all that and see all that you can be. And that's the most lovable thing. And you may be still too much identified with the disaster part. And the other part is trying to tell you, no, look all that you can be. Look the brightest side. But somehow we... And of course, if you realize, oh, that then I'm my worst enemy, actually. I push on this, I convince myself of how disastrous I am, and I over-identify with that, and that's the problem. Like I was watching the other day one psychologist, and it was an interesting point he made. You know? He was speaking about how we ourselves convince ourselves of certain things. So he was speaking with someone, like I'm speaking with Mirella, and say to Mirella, he will ask to the other person, like, Mirella, what if I tell you, you have very nice green hair? So you are smiling. So why are you smiling?
Because I don't have green hair.
Okay, good point. So what if I tell you, you are totally stupid and useless?
I'm not.
Generally, you won't be smiling. I mean, you already know how to reply probably, but generally the point he was making is when he said that to the person, what if I tell you are useless, stupid, and so on? The person was like serious. She said, so? The point is, you believe that to yourself. You follow my point. If I tell you have green hair, you say, I don't have that. I said, you are totally useless. Why don't you laugh? Because you are believing that narrative. You follow my point? So we are the ones who also choose how to limit ourselves and get stuck in a particular sense of identity. And of course, sometimes we need shelter, going back to the point, which means people that will show us, you are not what you think you are, and look at all that you can be. So we need to get to that point. I need shelter. I need help. I remember once I put something, I need help, and people started, is everything okay, Maharaj? What happened? I said, nothing happened. I need help. I mean, is that a bad word to say? I mean, it has to be a disaster. My house is burning or something to say, I need help. Don't you need help? Oh, yeah, I need help. But generally, we are not accustomed to express that. So if someone says that, it's like, oh, some terrible thing has happened. And it's just that we need help on a daily basis, but we are not accustomed to express. So I will emphasize that, not trying to acknowledge how much shelter we need and make a voluntary choice. Of course, be honest and sincere, and whenever we choose to take shelter, to do it also really, because it doesn't make sense to take shelter in it. I mean, if you say I'm taking shelter in part, like 50%, it's like how much you can call it take shelter. I mean, you may have now a limited capacity to take shelter, but ideally you should invest all your capacity, the one you have now, to take shelter. If you really believe that, if you don't believe that situation or person, of course do not take shelter yet. Because you are not taking shelter, actually. You are cheating yourself, thinking, I'm taking shelter. So that's why in our scriptures, over and over again, this emphasized. No, you don't accept a guru unless you really fully trust that person. It won't work. And vice versa, the guru also has to know the person. It's not just a superficial thing, a formal thing. You are giving your life to that person. And that person is giving your life to you. Don't forget the second part of the equation. It's two-way street. So if you feel that still you cannot do that, okay, wait. Don't force yourself to give something you cannot give. I mean, you cannot give yourself. Even if you force yourself, you are not giving yourself. So again, we shouldn't be interested in external show of giving ourselves. That's the most serious sacred act we have to perform, so we don't want to make a show out of that. That's has to be very substantial, very comprehensive, very sincere. So if it has to wait for some time, okay. Meanwhile, we are increasing our surrender, if you will, our trust, our faith. I mean, we need to have trust and faith in some way, in some direction, to a point that we can feel I can give myself full in this direction. I mean, we need to get to that point. At some point, this life, next life, some point, we should be building in that direction. If I still do not feel I can fully give myself here. Once Srila Siddhar Maharaj said that, interestingly, said, to not have a guru means that whatever I look, I feel I cannot trust. That was a very interesting definition. He described indirectly what does it mean to have a guru. He said, to not have a guru means whatever I'm looking, I feel I cannot trust. That means you don't have guru. Like making a parallel between guru and full feeling of I can trust fully here. So trust fully here means I'm giving fully myself here because I can trust fully. So we need to take the time to reach to that point. And of course, be honest enough to think also, if I do not feel that yet, doesn't mean that the person worthy of my trust and surrender has not come yet. probably it's right in front of my face, but probably it's something that I need to fix in me, and I'm not saying that with guilt or something, but just with objective situation that I need to work a little bit more on my giving capacity. And it's understandable. Some people may have gone through some, I don't know, traumatic experience where the trust muscle has been terribly damaged. So you can just expect, give yourself fully there. It's a pure devotee. You cannot see yourself. Maybe it's a pure devotee, but still, you have to solve your own part so you can give yourself fully, because that's how it works. Huh? Yeah, some words. We can say so many things about Saranagati, but I think that's a good way to close. So I think we'll finish here. I saw Namrasa made one question, but I think we can continue. The next one, Ramrasa, if you are there, please save that for next meeting. So thank you so much, and see you. I think tomorrow we have next meeting. Srila Gurudev ki jai, Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Harinam Sankirtan ki jai, Sri Giriraj Maharaj ki jai, Sri Jagannath Balaya Subhadra ki jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Gaur Premananda Hari Bol.